Hello, I'm Andrew, and welcome to this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News for the 20th of March, 2024.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by the sight loss charity Beacons. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. Once you've enabled the Talking Newspapers skill, all you need to do is play Talking Newspapers and ask for the Black Country Talking News. Our Talking News service is also available via the free Wireless for the Blind app. It can be found on the Beacon Centre website, www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast via services such as Apple or Spotify, or as a free CD. Simply contact Beacon Centre on 01902 880 111. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Reading for you this week, we have myself, Andrew, Angela, Ian, Christine, Helen, Mina, Simon, and of course, not forgetting, Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have the latest Beacon update from Helen with the nostalgia of the miners' strike. We have the latest local news for the Black Country. We have the quiz with Mina, all the latest football news from Wolves and West Brom, a Did You Know section from Flashback Roger. We hear from Mina, who has all the weather for the weekend. Local news to start, though, with Angela.
People in the Black Country with sudden onset eye problems can access a dedicated eye care service for urgent assessment and treatment. The Community Urgent Eye Care Service, CUES, is a free NHS service for anyone who is experiencing emergency eye care problems and is registered with a GP in the Black Country. The symptoms that can be treated by the service includes red or painful eye or eyelids, recently occurring flashes and floaters, recent and sudden loss of vision, or a foreign body in the eye. Adults and children can use a service which is available via participating opticians across the Black Country without the need for a GP referral. This service is not an eye test and does not cover long-standing or major eye conditions such as cataracts, diabetic retinopathy, or glaucoma. Those who have one of these conditions should contact their optometrist or hospital eye service directly for advice in the usual way. Saar Bassi, Director of Primary Care for the NHS Black Country Integrated Care Board, said, "It's important that we look after our eyes by having regular checkups with an optician. However, if you find yourself with a sudden urgent eye condition, the CUES can give advice and treatment without delay. In most cases, the CUES will be able to treat patients quickly and easily. And if hospital treatment is needed, the service will arrange an emergency appointment with an eye specialist at a hospital, meaning that patients have access to the right care straight away. In the Black Country, there is a hugely talented workforce in primary care opticians who have the equipment and skills required to assess, diagnose, and where necessary, treat eye problems. The CUES is a great example of providing more efficient care closer to home by minimising delays and reducing the need for hospital visits, and I would encourage people to access this service if they need urgent eye treatment. People can book an assessment with the Community Urgent Eye Care Service online. The self-referral service is coordinated by Primary Eye Care, the largest single not-for-profit primary eye care lead provider in England. Now, eye health is just as important as eyesight, so even if we have low vision, no vision, or an existing diagnosed sight condition, it is still important to have regular assessments and eye tests. This will make sure there are no problems developing that are obscured by the fact that your vision is poor to start with. But what if we may struggle to attend any appointments or are unable to get to our local opticians for an eye test? Well, to help us with this, here's Soundings contributor Iona, who explains who may be eligible for a home eye test, how to check availability, and what will happen at a home appointment.
Hello. This article is about having eye tests at home, what they involve, and who can have them. We know that regular eye examinations can help to highlight and prevent the development of serious issues with vision, and pick up on any changes in your eyesight at an early stage. This is essential for the correct prescription of lenses that help you to see better. Eye tests may also detect the presence of other health conditions such as high cholesterol, early diabetes, and high blood pressure, as well as a number of neurological issues. So, it is important that you have your eyes examined regularly in order to prevent these other health conditions from remaining undiagnosed and to monitor your general health. If you have a visual impairment, it can sometimes seem pointless to go to the optician for a standard eye test, because you already know you have a problem. But it is important to make sure you have your eyes checked regularly to ensure any developing problems are caught at an early stage. Sometimes, if you have an already recognised sight impairment, it can seem superfluous to go to the optician regularly, but that means you may miss out on diagnosis of new problems, such as cataracts or glaucoma, that may need attention to prevent your existing sight problems getting worse. In the case of cataracts, it's very important to detect them in their early stages. Likewise, undiagnosed and untreated glaucoma can lead to sight loss that could be slowed down or prevented by early intervention. So, the message is, don't dismiss the importance of regular eye tests with your local opticians, even if you have a recognised visual impairment. But what if you have difficulty in attending for an eye test? Perhaps you have a health condition that prevents you from travelling to have the test. This article explores the subject of eye tests that can be carried out by a qualified professional at your home, and whether you are eligible for this service. Let's look at eligibility first. Basically, if you or a person you care for has a mental or physical disability or illness, which means that you are unable to leave your home unaccompanied, you are eligible to have a free eye examination at your home. This also applies to people living in residential or care homes. So how do you arrange to have an eye test at home? You may contact your usual optician to discover whether home eye tests are part of their service. Not all opticians provide the service. Nevertheless, they should be able to let you know of other optometrists near where you live who do offer home testing. If you are 60 or over and currently living in the UK, you are eligible for a free NHS eye examination and will not have to pay for your eye test at home. If you have not reached the age of 60, you may still be eligible for a free eye test, but this depends on your circumstances. And in Scotland, eye examinations are free for everyone. The optometrist can explain exactly what you are entitled to when you call to organise your appointment. As for what will take place during a home visit, it is useful to know that most of the tests carried out are similar to those you would expect from an actual visit to the optician. However, the home visitor will not be bringing the huge equipment that you would see at the optician's. Instead, he or she will attend with a portable set of equipment, which will require some setting up in your home during the visit. As with all eye tests, the optometrist will ask you questions about your general health, your visual difficulties, and any glasses that you currently wear. You'll have the opportunity to discuss any particular issues that you've experienced with your eyesight. The examination will involve the following. First, you will be required to read letters of the alphabet on a chart, or to match symbols. Second, the outer eye will be examined in order to see that the outside of your eye is healthy and that your eyes react to a light source. Third, there will be checks made of your inner eye by shining a light into each eye. A light will be shone into your eye and you'll be asked to look in different directions. Tests will also be done to ascertain that the muscles of the eyes are working well. Fourth, tests will be carried out to discover if you need to wear glasses and what prescription the lenses must be. Fifth, your side vision, that's your peripheral vision, will be tested. You may also receive an eye pressure test, the most common being puffs of air blown at the front of each eye. As you probably know, this doesn't create pain or discomfort, but it can make you jump. After these tests, the optometrist will discuss the findings of the examination, and, if appropriate, you will be given a prescription for new glasses. If there is a reason for you to be seen at the hospital because of an eye condition, the optometrist will arrange for you to be referred to the right ophthalmologist, that's a hospital eye doctor, for your condition. If you are prescribed new glasses, the optometrist will have a selection of frames, so you can choose what you like most of all. If you have former frames that you wish to retain, you can ask the optometrist to see if they're still suitable. You should be in agreement about the cost of new glasses before going ahead with ordering them. You may be eligible for help with the cost of NHS glasses. You'll need to ask the optometrist about this. When your new glasses are ready for you, the optometrist will contact you to arrange delivery and to ensure that they fit well. If you keep a record of the name of your home visitor, you can easily contact him or her again if you have any further questions. Most difficulties can be dealt with quickly and easily. It is important to remember some key points about allowing a person you do not know into your home. So, when arranging an appointment, make sure that you make a note of the optometrist's name and also ask for identification when he or she arrives. You may find it reassuring to have a relative or friend at the house when the home visitor comes to visit, if you have anxiety about this. Please note that some large opticians, such as Specsavers, offer a home hearing test as well as an eye test, so that might be a useful additional service to consider. So it is important not to delay or miss out on an eye examination if you cannot easily leave the house. Instead, call your usual optician and find out if you are eligible for a home visit.
TNF Soundings.
Up next, we hear from Helen, who, as usual, has our latest Beacon update.
Hi everyone, it's Helen from Beacon, back with your weekly update and fairs this week. Do you want to make a difference in your community? Well, you can join us as a volunteer at the Beacon Centre for the Blind. Whether you're passionate about supporting those with sight loss or you get to give back, volunteering with us offers a rewarding experience like no other. Come along to our open day on March the 21st at our Wolverhampton Clearing Centre from 10am to 3pm to learn more about how you can get involved. Can't make it? Well, just give us a call 01902 880 111 to find out how you can make a difference. Now, next this week, did you know smoking doubles your chances of losing your sight? Well, it's recently been National No Smoking Day, so we want you to protect your vision by taking steps to stub out your habit. For more help and support to stop smoking, visit www.wolverhampton.gov.uk/be-smoke-free. Now, many of us will be marking Ramadan this month, and if that's you, we extend warm wishes to all those observing the holy month. We wish you a blessed Ramadan filled with peace and reflection. And don't forget, if you use eye drops, it's important to maintain your eye care routine during this period. Last this week, Hop to it and grab your ticket for the Beacon Centre's Easter Raffle. You could be the lucky winner of a gigantic chocolate Easter egg towering over 1 metre tall. Or you could snag our delightful Easter hamper as second prize. Tickets are only £1 each and available in any of our retail shops or online at www.justgiving.com/Beacons Easter Raffle 2024. That's it for this week. I'll be back again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for that update, Helen. Next up, we have another block of local news. And up first, we hear from Christine.
Now, I'm sure we've all endured a few bumps in the road. It comes with the territory. Well, it has been announced that almost £10 million will help to tackle pothole-plagued roads and improve highways in Wolverhampton over the next year. A dedicated fund of £500,000 included within that figure has been set aside to tackle potholes and will support the city's existing pothole budget. Over the past year, more than 6,800 potholes have been repaired on routes across the city, with more than 53,000 pothole repairs made in Wolverhampton during the past decade. Other proposed highway improvements planned over the next year include major maintenance and resurfacing schemes across the city, road safety and traffic management work, upgrading the council's car park management system, street lighting improvements, and the delivery of further Safer Routes to Schools programmes. There will be improvements to Ring Road and city centre signage, as well as structural reviews and works on a number of bridges. In addition, there will be the culmination of the council's programme to convert older streetlights to LEDs to reduce carbon emissions. More than 24,550 streetlights have already been converted. The council will carry out the work under the next phase of its highway capital programme, which has a total budget of £9.7 million. Funding for the programme has come through external grants and council resources. Since 2020-21, the programme has delivered more than £30 million worth of improvement and development work. Many of the projects have been carried out thanks to the council's success in bidding for funding through the West Midlands Combined Authority. Completed improvements in 2023-24 include 6 road safety and safer routes to schools projects, 4.5 kilometres of carriageway has been resurfaced, and 13.8 kilometres of carriageway has received surface treatments. In addition, there has been an expansion of Wolverhampton's CCTV network, further rollout of electronic driver information signs, which support the new guidance system managing car parks across the city, and extension of the council's smart technology systems, which support traffic information. Councillor Craig Collingswood, Cabinet Member for Environment and Climate Change at Wolverhampton Council, said, "This is a major investment in our transport network and shows our commitment to providing a smooth and seamless journey through our city. We know that the condition and safety of our roads really matters to our residents, and it matters to us too. This is why we're making the most of all available funding by ensuring that this additional £500,000 helps to tackle potholes, a problem which affects roads both here in Wolverhampton and all across the country. The planned improvements are pending approval and will be discussed at Wolverhampton Council's Cabinet meeting this week."
And focus in the region is not just on the holes in our roads, but strides are also being taken to crack down on the mounds of rubbish from fly tippers on the sides of roads in Wolverhampton. Wolverhampton Council has caught and fined fly tippers who have dumped rubbish, including a mattress, bagged waste and sofas, with a total of 11 fixed penalty notices issued since the start of the year, with hundreds of pounds paid in fines over the last 2 months. Many of the fly tippers were caught on council security cameras, with one identified by an address found on some packaging in dumped waste, another captured on CCTV supplied by a member of the public, and one witnessed and reported by a member of the public under the council's Shop a Tipper campaign. The waste was dumped throughout the city, with incidents in Wensfield, Bilston, Whitmarines, Blakenhall and Penn Fields. In the most recent incident, a witness was walking their dog in the early hours of the morning when they saw a man leave his property with a bin bag full of waste. The witness then saw the offender throw the bag over a wall and reported the crime to the council. Officers were able to visit the fly tipper and hand deliver an FPN, which was paid. The witness was thanked for coming forward and will now receive a £100 Enjoy Wolverhampton gift card. FPNs are set at £400 and the money raised by payment of the fines is reinvested in the council's environmental crime service to help bring to justice those who fail to dispose of their waste correctly. Under the council's ongoing Shop a Tipper campaign, anyone suspected of dumping rubbish will see their images shared on lampposts to appeal for information to help identify them. If the information provided leads to successful identification and FPNs are issued and paid or a prosecution takes place, residents receive a £100 Enjoy Wolverhampton gift card. Residents can contact 01902 5527 00 with information. Councillor Craig Collingswood, Cabinet Member for Environment and Climate Change at Wolverhampton Council, said, "This is an excellent result in our ongoing battle against fly tipping. It's a disgusting crime and one that is a priority for the Council to tackle. We are sending a strong message to thoughtless fly tippers that we will take action to stop this criminal behaviour and keep Wolverhampton and its local neighbourhoods and streets clean and attractive. Residents are reminded that waste can be disposed of free of charge at the tips in Anchor Lane, Lanesfield, Bilston and Shore Road, Wolverhampton. A bulky item collection service to dispose of big unwanted items is also available."
And waste dumped across the region through fly tipping is not only an illegal act, but this, along with the mindless acts of litter critters, is also a serious risk to the wildlife of the Black Country too. The RSPCA has received almost 13,000 reports about animals found severely injured, trapped, mutilated, choked, or even killed by carelessly discarded litter over the past 4 years. And out of all the counties in England and Wales, the West Midlands took fifth place in the league of litter-related incidents, which have caused severe injuries and even the death of some animals, with 437 reported to the RSPCA over that time period. The shocking new data released by the charity also reveals that it received an average of 13 reports per day last year during the peak months of May, June, July and August, when there is a particular litter hazard for animals. Now, the RSPCA is urging people to help create a better world for every animal by getting involved in Keep Britain's Tidy's Great British Spring Clean, which runs until the 31st of March. Individuals, groups or schools can pledge their support and say how many bags of litter they intend to pick up, with more than 400,000 collected in total last year. Distressing incidents dealt with by the RSPCA included a hedgehog entangled in old barbed wire, a fox cub with litter caught around his neck, a goose with an old drinks can stuck onto her lower beak, and a great black-backed gull whose leg became almost completely detached due to old fishing line cutting into it. Amongst mammals, litter-related reports to the RSPCA were highest for foxes, hedgehogs and deer. While among wild birds, swans, pigeons and gulls bore the greatest brunt of discarded rubbish. The RSPCA even received reports of family pets such as cats and dogs being affected by litter. RSPCA Anti-Litter Campaigns Manager Carrie Stone said, "Our rescuers deal with thousands of avoidable incidents every year where animals have been impacted by litter. Old drinks cans and bottles, plastic items and even disposable vapes are just some of the items that pose a danger to our wildlife, including hedgehogs, deers and foxes. animals can ingest the litter or become entangled, leading to injuries, mutilations, and even death. Sadly, for every animal we're able to help, there are probably many others that go unseen, unreported, and may even lose their lives. But the public can help us protect animals and avoid these incidents happening in the first place. Spring is an ideal time to go on a litter pick because it falls before the breeding season when young animals, such as fox cubs, are at risk of getting into trouble, while litter in hedges will be more visible to pickers before the vegetation really starts growing. That's why we're calling on the public to get involved in the Great British Spring Clean to help remove litter that may endanger animals. But it's also really easy for the public to help at all times of the year. When people are out and about, we urge them to hold on to their litter until there is an opportunity to dispose of it safely and responsibly, or recycle where appropriate. As we all strive to create a better world for every animal, this could save an animal's life. As well as everyday rubbish, the RSPCA also sees many animals arriving into its care with terrible injuries caused by angling litter, such as discarded fishing line, hooks, and plastic netting. Around 40% of all litter-related calls to the RSPCA last year were about animals that had specifically become caught in fishing litter. As was reported last month, the RSPCA is also warning that discarded biodegradable food litter also poses dangers, putting many animals at risk of road traffic collisions. Now it's time to test your knowledge, as we have the quiz questions for this edition brought to us by Mina.
Hello and welcome to this week's flashback quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers Did You Know feature. But for now, these are your questions. Here we go.
Question 1. Where is the real place named Dulally? Question 2. What colour would you expect to see on a guilty person's hands? Question 3. What was the name of the whip the Navy used in a flogging punishment? Question 4. What does to butter someone up mean? Question 5. What did hatters use in the 17th century that made them mad? And finally, question 6. How do you treat an unwelcome person? I will be back later in the show to share all the answers, but for now, best of luck!
Cheers for those questions, Mina. I'll get my mind working on them. Up now, however, is another block of local news.
One of the biggest Minton Majolica ceramic pieces ever seen, bought for a few pounds in the Black Country in 1950, could sell for thousands of pounds at auction. Some 74 years ago, factory worker Anne Pincher paid £25, the equivalent of £786 today, for the striking Victorian exhibition piece made by pottery firm Minton & Co. of Stoke-on-Trent. The rare decorative object, which measures a mighty 99 centimetres wide, 45 centimetres deep, and 62.5 centimetres high, used to take pride of place in her front room in Darlaston. But later, her majestic majolica was displayed on her landing, where it ended up being filled with general bric-a-brac, including tights. It was a quirky but practical use for the piece, which is listed in the 1871 art journal as Shell Flower Bearers. A similar example was displayed at London's Victoria and Albert exhibition in 1873. It has dramatic curves and an elaborate shell shape, seemingly held aloft by two mermaids with golden tresses. Intoxicating thanks to its colour and detail, it is one of the biggest Minton Majolica ceramics pieces Hanson's Auctioneers has ever offered at auction. Anne's daughter Marilyn, a retired legal secretary from Warsaw, said, "When Mum first bought her Minton, she put it in the front room for everyone to see. She bought it from some antique dealer friends in Warsaw. Goodness knows how she transported it the few miles to her home in Darlaston, probably by horse and cart." As the years rolled by, Anne's £25 antique grew in value and even ended up on TV's Antiques Roadshow. It's now set to go under the hammer, guided at £4,000 to £6,000 in Hanson's Auctioneers' March 21st Derbyshire Fine Art Auction, and the sky's the limit. Marilyn said, "I inherited the piece when my mum passed away at the age of 83 in 1995. In 1990, when Mum was 78, the News of the World ran stories about finding a fortune in the attic, and they included a piece about her Minton. The article said it had been valued at £3,000 to £4,000, but 8 years earlier, someone had offered Mum a meagre £100 for it. In 1997, Antiques Roadshow came to Warsaw, and I got in touch with them. They kindly asked one of their experts, the late Henry Sandon, to interview me. Henry said Mum's Minton was worth £10,000, but to get it insured for £15,000. A story about the TV appearance made news in the Warsaw Advertiser. Gillian Finney, connoisseur ceramics consultant at Hanson's Auctioneers, said, "It's a truly spectacular piece, a rare Minton Majolica marvel made in the Stoke Potteries in the 1870s. We're guiding it at £4,000 to £6,000, but hope it flies higher. It's an important part of Minton and England's ceramic history." So what exactly are Minton Majolica ceramics? Ian can tell us a little bit more.
I sure can, Christine. The roots of Majolica pottery date back to the mid-15th century, when Majolica, its original name, reached Italy from Spain, Majorca and beyond. This pottery was made with a tin glaze process. From the mid-19th century, Majolica, made by a simpler process, emerged. Coloured lead silicate glazes were applied directly to an article, then fired. This resulted in brightly coloured, hard-wearing, inexpensive wares that were both useful and decorative. This type of Majolica was introduced at the 1851 Great Exhibition in London, and Minton & Co., founded in 1793 by English potter Thomas Minton, 1765 to 1836, led the way. Jill added, "Minton was Europe's top ceramic factory during the Victorian era. As well as pottery vessels and sculptures, the firm was a leading manufacturer of tiles and other architectural ceramics. They produced work for London's Houses of Parliament and United States Capitol. This exhibition piece is an impressive example of their design caliber. It deserves to be in a major collection or museum. For more information, visit hansonslive.co.uk.
Now, after hearing that story from Christine and Ian, I think I may plan a spring clear out too, just in case I also have a prized piece in the attic. And for those other household items, there will also be a chance to gift all that may no longer be required at a community sharing event next month. As Dudley Council is holding its second Too Good to Throw Away event on Tuesday, April the 9th, following the success of one held earlier this year. People can take unwanted household items that are in good working order to St Andrew's Church in Sedgley between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. Items accepted for the community repurposing event include curtains, bedding, cushions, kitchenware, small electrical items, clothes, food, and unused toiletries. A full list of wanted items can be found online at dudley.gov.uk/council-community/starting-over/. The local authority held the first event of its kind in Pedmore in January, and more than 2 tonnes of unwanted household items were donated and sent to local charity Provision House. Councillor Ian Bevan, the Council's Cabinet Member for Health and Wellbeing, said, "We are really pleased to be holding another one of our Too Good to Throw Away events. This is a great way for people to have a spring clean in their homes, with items being passed on to families and individuals who are in need." Councillor Dr. Rob Clinton, Cabinet Member for Climate Change at Dudley Council, said the initiative is part of the Council's Climate Action Plan, and he added, "It helps to reduce waste by redistributing and reusing perfectly good things that will be very much appreciated by households within the borough." Councillor Damien Caulfield, Cabinet Member for Highways and Environment, added, "It is important that all our residents take time to think about how objects could be repurposed before throwing them away. We are really pleased to be supporting this ongoing community scheme." Visitors are asked to park in Castle Street car park when attending the event. Furniture, soft furnishings or white goods will not be accepted.
Now that sounds like a great opportunity to scout out some new glad rags, which may just come in handy for a wonderful new local initiative. As Age UK are hosting daytime discos for the over 50s, helping to unite people with a passion for dancing. The event, run by the charity's Wolverhampton branch, is held at multiple venues across the city and features music from the 1950s, 60s and 70s in the hope of creating a social activity that also promotes fitness. Jane Crutchley, 69, started dancing in her late 20s and said she regularly attended the discos to have a boogie. "Everything washes away when you start dancing. You forget everything and all the tension and stress just melts away," she said. Ms. Crutchley said she loved that the disco played music that took her back to her youth, bringing back many memories. The former early years practitioner said many participants felt lucky to have the disco as an opportunity to not only dance but meet other people. "This disco, it's our time, and the music is very us," she said. "You go home feeling relaxed, and there's such a lovely atmosphere when you're dancing." Brian Nibbs started ballroom dancing in the upstairs of pubs like the Custard House in Small Heath, Birmingham, more than 40 years ago. Now aged 69, dancing is still a big part of Mr. Nibbs' life. He goes ballroom dancing 3 times a week and has been attending the discos for nearly 2 years. "Dancing gets me out of the house. It's kept me sane. You've got to motivate yourself," he said. "The atmosphere is fantastic. It's better than money in the bank." John Ault from Purton, Wolverhampton, said he had been kept alive by dancing and even met his wife on the dance floor in Wolves Social Club back in 1969. The 77-year-old said he requested different songs at the daytime discos so the music did not get stale. "Every song brings back memories," he said, "and you're back at home in your nest at 7 p.m, which feels much safer." Demand has grown so much that organisers are now holding 2 events in Wensfield every month. From ballroom to rock and roll, Mr. Ault said he was born to dance. "This is back like the old days. where your clothes had got to be wringing with sweat. You know if the cold hits you, you've had a good time, he said. Mark Guest from Age UK Wolverhampton founded the daytime disco movement in 2022 to keep older people active and socialising with others. We wanted that vibe of going out on a Friday night, and we wanted them to feel 18 again, he said. Mr. Guest hopes to open more daytime discos across the Black Country and welcomed people to join.
More local news to follow, but now
we have another bulletin of practical information and sight loss tips from Pete.
If you're struggling with reading and need a magnifier, have you ever considered a video magnifier, or sometimes known as a digital magnifier? Well, Beacon have a range of video magnifiers that you can come in and try. Now, a video magnifier, you can increase or decrease the magnification so you can turn it up a bit, or you can turn it up quite a lot to help you read. You can change contrast settings on a video magnifier, so you can look at something in true colour, or you could change the contrast to black on white, or white on black, or yellow on black, or black on yellow. It's whatever works best for you, so there's a range of combinations there that you can try to find the right one. You can also freeze images on a video magnifier. So let's say there's something in your fridge, a piece of some food. You could take a little picture, because the angle's a bit difficult to read, of it, and then bring the magnifier away and then zoom it up. So if it's something like the sell-by dates or ingredients on food, you can read it comfortably there. So video magnifiers range from small handheld magnifiers you can sit comfortably in an armchair to read with, up to medium-sized ones, which are about the size of laptops, and then there's desktop magnifiers with big, large 24-inch screens, which really make magnification strong. So, if you would like to try a video magnifier to see if that would help you, you're very welcome to. Just call Beacon's Sight Loss Advisors for an appointment. And remember, bring something you struggle to read with you. So if you'd like to try a video magnifier, give us a call on 01902 880 111 and ask for a Sight Loss Advisor. 01902 880111.
Now then, with thanks to Mark Andrews of the Express and Star, the Black Country Talking News brings Imagine You series looking back at the dispute and our region's part in it. Miners' Strike 40 Years On, Episode 3.
A Tale of Two Coal Miners. In March 1984, Alan and Patrick were both youngish miners at Littleton Colliery near Cannock. Both were members of the NUM, but from there on their lives would take very different paths. Alan needed little persuading to join the action and was out for the duration, struggling to make ends meet over 12 bitter months. Patrick took the view that his own union branch had voted against the strike and that there was no democratic mandate for a walkout. Friendships were broken and he was shunned by his neighbours for crossing the picket lines. Alan, now 70, is Alan Pearson, now a Labour councillor and chairman of Cannock Chase District Council. Patrick is now Lord McLoughlin, a former chairman of the Conservative Party and a cabinet minister in David Cameron's government. 40 years on, their memories of the dispute are very different. What do you think it was like, retorts Councillor Pearson, when asked about his experiences during the dispute. How would you have found it, being on strike for a year with no money coming in and having a mortgage to pay? The hardships endured by miners who took part in the strike are well documented, but it seems crossing the picket lines was never a consideration. Wouldn't you do what you could for someone who needed your help, he says. People faced losing their livelihoods and we were out to support them. At the end of the strike, when we came back to work, the ones that had been working clapped us on our return. What does that tell you? Did he have any friends who crossed him on the picket line? I had colleagues who went to work, but there's a difference between friends and colleagues, he said carefully. Was it not possible to be friends with miners who worked during the dispute? His demeanour softens slightly. I've got friends who went to work during the strike, he said. We all had to do what we thought was right, given our circumstances. It went on for a year, and some of them couldn't hold out. They had to go back to work. I stayed to the end, but there were those who felt they couldn't go on. There seems little doubt, though, that if he had his time again, he would do exactly the same.
For Lord McCoughlin, the question of going out on strike hinged on the mechanics of the ballot. Had there been a national ballot, I would have gone on strike, he says. As a 22-year-old miner and fully paid-up member of the NUM, young Patrick got a fair bit of ribbing when he stood to become a Tory councillor on Cannet Chase Council in 1980. There were even more raised eyebrows when he stood for the Conservatives against Wolverhampton South East MP Bob Edwards at the 1983 general election. But the jibes were always good-natured, and politics wasn't really something that people talked about down the pit. There was good banter, there was a lot of leg pulling, he recalls. The funny thing was, most of the miners were far more right-wing than me. They just happened to vote Labour. But he found humour in short supply the following year when he crossed the picket line in defiance of his National Union bosses. There was a ballot in the Western area of which Staffordshire was part, and members voted overwhelmingly, from memory I think it was about 74 to 26, to go to work. I then looked at Arthur Scargill, who was trying to have a political fight with a party I supported, and I decided I wasn't going to be intimidated by him. Many of the people who previously viewed his political activity as a bit of harmless eccentricity now saw him as the enemy. There were people I had got on with who didn't speak to me after the strike, he recalls. My life changed quite a lot. Lord McLaughlin said tensions were highest in the early months of the dispute. In the beginning, people did feel intimidated, he said. At Littleton, there were about 2,000 people employed. Not all of them were NUM members, but a lot of them were. And at the beginning, there were something like 20 people crossing the picket line. There were times when it was very terrifying. We used to meet at the back of the DHSS car park in Cannock, and we would have a police escort so we could get into work. There were a lot of pickets who were trying to stone us, so we were trying to outwit those using different gates to go in. By the time the dispute ended, 80% of the workforce had already returned to work, and the tensions had eased a little, but many were still not in the mood for reconciliation. The people living next door were on strike all the way through, and they never spoke to us after that.
Lord McLaughlin believes that the way the strike unfolded would have been very different had NUM leader Arthur Scargill called a vote. The whole problem would have been avoided. Everyone would have gone out on strike, he says. In Patrick McLaughlin's case, the bad blood was relatively short-lived. About 6 months after the return to work, he swapped his job as an underground belt attendant for a post in the National Coal Board marketing office. And the following year, he left Cannock after winning a by-election in the neighbouring constituency of West Derbyshire. Has history and the subsequent closure of Littleton Colliery proved Arthur Scargill right, that Ian McGregor's modernisation programme was the thin end of the wedge? I don't think so, says Lord McLaughlin. If you look through history, mines have always closed. There were far more closures between 1964 and 1970 when there happened to be a Labour government. Littleton had been operating for over 100 years when it closed. If you are extracting materials from beneath the ground for that length of time, there is bound to come a time when it is no longer viable. Governments want to spend money on the health service, education and defence, not subsidising uneconomic coal pits. It's all about green energy now. We are trying to cut down on coal to meet net zero targets. Last time they tried to open a couple of new coal mines, it was opposed by the Labour Party.
Up next, it's trivia time, brought to us by Flashback Roger and his Did You Know feature. Take it away, Roger.
Hello again, everyone. I hope that you find this week's crop of oddities as interesting as I did in my browsing. Any road up, here we go, as I think you're going to enjoy them. So, did you know that? Doolally tap is a saying that I've used often, as I'm sure you have. It means to go temporarily crazy. Well, Doolally was actually a transit camp in India, where British troops were sent awaiting a ship back to the UK. It was so hot and humid that some lost their minds temporarily, as the wait for a ship could be lengthy and boring. It was also known as Camp Fever. And to be caught red-handed means to be caught in the act of doing something wrong. This originates from an old English law that ordered any person could be punished for butchering an animal that wasn't his own. The only way the person could be convicted, however, was if he was caught with the animal's blood still on his hands. And what's the matter? Has a cat got your tongue? It was asked of a person who is lost for words. It originated in the English Navy, who used to use a whip called the cat o' nine tails for flogging. Pain was so severe that it caused the victim to stay quiet for a long time. But another possible source could be from ancient Egypt, where liars and blasphemers' tongues were cut out and fed to the cats. And then to butter someone up, it means to impress someone with flattery. This was a customary religious act in ancient India. The devout would throw butterballs at the statues of their gods to seek favour and forgiveness. And he's as mad as a hatter. It means to be completely crazy. Its origins date from the 17th and 18th centuries. In 17th century France, poisoning occurred amongst the hat makers who used mercury for hat felt. The mad hatter's disease was marked by shyness, irritability and tremors that make the person appear mad. It has nothing to do with Alice in Wonderland though. And to give a cold shoulder means to being unwelcoming or antisocial towards someone. The first recorded use of this phrase dates back to the early 1800s. It refers to an old custom of giving an unwelcome guest a piece of cold meat from the shoulder of mutton or pork or beef, as opposed to a welcome guest who received a warm serving. This was a polite way to communicate and saying, "You may leave now." Well, did you enjoy those? I do hope so. I'm sure that I must have said them at some point in the conversation at some time in the past, as you must have too. Any road up is another saying of mine each week. I'll go and stick the kettle on and do a mug of tea and have a Kit Kat. And that means, of course, there's goodbye for this week. But I'll be back, so ta-ra a bit, ta-ra!
Up now we have to hear what the weather has in store for us. Brought to us, come rain or shine, by our own Sunny Mina.
The weather for this week ahead is forecast to remain unsettled with plenty of showers, but with a gentle breeze coming up from the south, we should hopefully see more spells of sunshine as we progress through the week. In result, UV levels may fluctuate between low and medium. The sunrise and sunset times are 5:50 a.m. for the sunrise and 6:35 p.m. for the sunset. Friday 22nd of March is forecast to have a wet start to the day, with the chance of sunny intervals breaking through in the afternoon. With a moderate westerly breeze, temperatures are forecast to be mild at around 14 degrees. Moving on, an unsettled mix of sunshine and showers looks set to continue into the weekend, with both Saturday and Sunday brightening up as we head into the afternoon. With the winds continuing to drive in from the west, a breezy weekend also means temperatures will remain mild at 13 degrees. On to next week, where the spells of wet weather will start to ease off and we should begin to see a few longer, drier spells of weather. It is forecast for sunny intervals and a gentle breeze to remain in the region from Monday 25th of March and continue right through to Thursday 28th of March. With light winds coming up from the southwest, this should help keep temperatures above average as they are forecast to remain in double digits all week, with highs of 14 degrees. There is a chance that Wednesday may buck the trend and be a total washout with showers throughout the day, but in the main, it looks like it's set to be a lovely week ahead. As always, do take care. Enjoy the weather.
Cheers for that weather update, Mina. Now it's time to find out how our local football teams have been getting on.
For everyone connected with Wolves, Saturday's drama will hurt for some time. The second half was a proper FA Cup tie with two teams eager to attack. For the neutral, it was scintillating. But for Wolves, to have dragged themselves into a winning position so late in the game, it was criminal to throw it away and lose 3-2. On the balance of the performances, however, Coventry deserved to win. They found a way to disrupt Wolves, create chances, and force chaotic moments that ultimately led to three good goals. Wolves, however, never got into their stride. Even when they had good moments in the first half, they lacked any real goal threat. The first goal was a well-worked move, but seemed to result in Ellis Sims handling the ball as he bundled it over the line. For VAR to stick with the on-field decision from officials that had no chance of seeing what happened in a crowded box is farcical. Even more outrageous was the several minutes VAR took to come to a decision. Football is dying from the VAR disease. Despite that, Coventry deserved to lead, and it does not change Wolves' performance. As Gary O'Neill rightly put it, the VAR decision was not the reason Wolves lost. The inspiration for Wolves' comeback then came courtesy of Rayan Aynouri. Moved to play further forward as Wolves desperately chased the game, he expertly took advantage of a defensive error to score the equaliser, before an impressive run and pass set up Hugo Bueno for what should have been the winning goal. The 22-year-old was already having a brilliant season, but on his return from the Africa Cup of Nations, he is proving to be a priceless asset for a Wolves side struggling for numbers. Aynouri's display deserved to be on the winning side on Saturday, even if some of his teammates did not. From that moment, Wolves should have seen the game out. To have got to the 97th minute at 2-1, from 9 minutes of injury time, Wolves should have been preparing for a trip to Wembley. Instead, a group that has done so well this season wilted. The equaliser was another good move to set up Sims for a free header, but Matt Doherty and Bueno, in particular the latter, should have done better to defend it. Had Totti Gomez been on the pitch, Wolves would probably not have conceded a goal there, and they would have seen out the game. Then to hand Coventry a 100th minute winner is unacceptable. It was an excellent finish from Hadji Wright, set up by Sims, and it proved once again how that attacking pair had bullied Wolves defenders all afternoon. The game was gone. Jubilation turned to despair, and Wolves missed out on a massive opportunity to get to Wembley. João Gomes was one of several dejected players at full time, and he had to be physically dragged from his knees. Any suggestion that this team did not show heart or care is ludicrous. They simply lacked the quality on the day. They are also a very emotional group, and although they have done good work on improving their game management under O'Neill, Saturday proves they still have a long way to go on that front. The head coach's job will now be to lift this emotional group from this low, with an important final 10 games of the Premier League season to come. The international break has come at a good time for Wolves. It allows them to rest, take stock, and get over Saturday before turning their attention to a West Midlands derby at Villa. Wolves have a number of very winnable games coming up in their race for European football, but they must now do it with several important players on the sidelines. The injuries to key individuals played a big part in Wolves losing to Coventry, and their misery was compounded by the news that Pedro Neto is likely to miss the rest of the season with a serious hamstring injury. The outlook was slightly brighter on the injuries to Mateus Cunha, Hwang Hee-chan, Jean-Ritner Bellegarde, and Craig Dawson. but Wolves are still far from full strength for what was already a tiny squad. Pablo Sarabia is the only fit senior attacking player left, and he failed to make any impact against Coventry. Nathan Fraser has only recently come back from a hip issue, and on Saturday he looked fatigued. He struggled to impose himself and Wolves had little attacking outlet. Yet O'Neill now needs to put a team out to face Villa that is capable of scoring goals. He needs to find the right solutions in the coming weeks, or face watching the season fizzle out. And for the Albion, it feels like the Baggies are entering the final straight and a playoff position is within their grasp. As in the most critical period of the campaign, Carlos Corber and side have found their most consistent form. Saturday's routine 2-0 victory over mid-table Bristol City was just that, routine. It was unspectacular, done with minimal fuss, and unlikely to warrant any full match replays, unless you go by the name of Corber, and that is. Supporters merely watched on with little drama, no concern and very little doubt as their side's seventh home win in 8 games felt all wrapped up by the time Jed Wallace doubled the lead on 50 minutes. Albion are now extremely well placed for playoff action come May, which remains a remarkable effort from the head coach, staff and players. That praise should extend to non-football staff behind the scenes too, who were able to guide the club forward in the turmoil and uncertainty of a change in ownership. The choppy waters of dwindling finances kept afloat by loans. The club's picture off the field is totally different now under Shilen Patel and his family in Florida. The days of Guachuan Lai are still a fresh memory, and the club shall continue to deal with the repercussions for some time, but it appears prosperous days are ahead. On the pitch, Corberan deserves significant credit for guiding the clubs into this position. Some may argue the Spaniards' squad is good enough to be pushing for a top 6 spot in this division, but this is as strong a championship, certainly at the top end, as it has been for a good while. That aside, Albion have been in 5th place in the division, almost exclusively barring a week or two since October. The top 4 have gallivanted into the sunset in that time, but the Baggies, best of the rest, have not been disillusioned or allowed themselves to be a target for any number of clubs beneath them, who have all traded places and seen form come and go in a bid to try to hang on to Albion's coattails in 5th. 8 points clear of Hull in 7th, who admittedly boast a game in hand with 8 league games remaining. The way Albion are playing, some of the sides they have left to face, and players due to return from injury, it would take quite the wobble to drop out of the top 6 from here. Saturday wasn't perfect. Bristol City are funny opposition. Skipper Wallace said as much afterwards. They have a peculiar style under rookie boss Liam Manning and are, as usual, middling in the table, with patchy form at best. The Hawthorns fell flat after an exuberant early atmosphere. There was more feeling in the liquidator as home fans rejoiced Wolves' FA Cup collapse against Coventry, as a flat contest lacking in temper or urgency broke out. The game desperately lacked a spark in the final third, and the only time it threatened was the visitor's Tommy Conway denied one-on-one by Alex Palmer. It was the only real save Palmer had to make all day, but he makes those saves so well, making himself big to prevent oncomers. A 16th clean sheet of the league season in 38 games, only Leeds goalkeeper is just ahead. That could have changed the game's projection, but Tom Fellows' opener on the stroke of half-time changed everything. What a 2024 the homegrown gem is enjoying. He capped a week that involved the first international call. He heads away with England's under-20s this week with his 5th Albion goal, a 4th in the league, and all since the turn of the year. It was an excellent left-footed finish. Wallace's tap in 5 minutes after half-time, after great work from Mikey Johnston and the returning Connor Townsend, felt like it all but sealed the victory. It could have been by a greater margin. Grady Diangana, Johnston, Oke Yokuslu and Fellows saw openings come and go before the Robins huffed and puffed at a late rally, flicking the woodwork twice. But in truth, comfortable Albion were barely stretched. It felt like Albion hardly had to find third gear. Celtic loanee Johnston, while not adding to his goal tally or registering an assist, was influential in the build-up to both goals, and for the first time at Albion played 90 minutes, something not lost on Corberan afterwards. The Spaniards' recruitment of the wing ace unquestionably breathed new life into Albion's playoff quest. The outlook ahead is bright. A near fortnight break is nicely timed. A chance to refuel. Yes, a break in good momentum. One defeat in 10, but weary limbs rested as players are off until Thursday. The prospect of Matt Phillips and Josh Meyer, two more attackers recovering for the other side of the break, is a useful one. There is work to do. Corberan won't let his side forget that, but the 46-game finish line is in sight.
Now, here come the quiz
answers,
and they're brought to us by Mina.
Hello, and here are your answers for this week's flashback quiz. Feeling confident? How will you score? Let's see. Question 1. Where is the real place named Dulali? And the answer? It's in India. Question 2. What colour would you expect to see on a guilty person's hands? And the answer is red. Question 3. What was the name of the whip the Navy used in flogging punishment? And the answer here is it was called a cat o' nine tails. Question 4. What does to butter someone up mean? And the answer, it means to try to impress. Question 5. What did hatters use in the 17th century that made them mad? And the answer, it was mercury. And finally, question 6. How did you treat an unwelcome person? And the answer? Give them the cold shoulder. Did you get them all right? If not, not to worry, as I will be back next week to test you all once again. Bye for now.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra! Oh,